Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, get ready for it. Get ready for the onslaught of images and headlines proclaiming the top stories of 2003, the top photos of the year, and the top songs and websites and films and trends and fashions and gadgets and so on. This hour, we're not doing that. Instead, we're talking about the stories that didn't get enough attention over the past year. New stories that were shoved aside in the rush to make space for embedded reporter, stories that were successfully suppressed, stories of where those of us in the media just, I don't know, got lazy. Now, I know you have ideas about this, and we're asking you to give us a call and tell us what story you think didn't get the coverage it deserved, but I need a little more from you as well. I'd like you to tell us why you think certain stories don't get that attention. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be checking in through the hour with reporters who have their own ideas about stories that were missed. And helping us throughout the hour is Geneva Overholser. She's now editorial writer and professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. She's also been editor of the Des Moines Register and ombudsman for the Washington Post and has been with us on The Connection before. Geneva, it's nice to have you back on the program.
It's great to be here, Dick. Thanks.
Now, when we asked you this question, you marked a story that I wouldn't have thought would come up as sort of a number one contender for stories missed. Maybe that tells us something.
Yeah, well, my number one nominee, I think partly because it's a story that could make a difference in the future about more missed stories, is the Federal Communications Commission's rules on media ownership.
Can you give us the sort of executive summary of just what changed?
Yeah. I think the reason that it is significant is because these were proposals that affected ownership in substantial ways. A couple of them stand out. One is these proposals allow one company to own a higher proportion of media outlets in the nation. For example, one company could own a greater number of television stations throughout the country than previously. Mm-hmm. And another piece of the commission changes were to allow one corporation to own more media in a given city. So you could own both the local television, one of the local television stations, and the newspaper. And these make a real difference in people's lives in terms of the diversity of the news sources coming to a given individual out in the country.
I remember back when Disney took over ABC, and ever since then, you know, reporters have joked rather, I think in a good-natured way, about ABC reporters getting their orders from the mouse. Tell me why this is actually going to make a difference in the stories that we get next year and in the years after that. What worries you about this?
Well, I think we can use what I would argue is a dramatic failure of coverage on this particular story to illuminate it. If I may, I would argue that this story was undercovered precisely because corporate owners approved of the FCC regulations. Now, you could say, okay, fine, they approved of it. Nevertheless, their media sources, their newsrooms, should have covered it vigorously. And, you know, the right will win out if it was an appropriate thing to do. There were plenty of arguments on behalf of it. Mm-hmm. Then it could win out. But the fact is, newsrooms just really didn't cover it. And I think it's a blatant example of the corporate interests of the given medium prevailing over the public's need to know. And if this can happen when the story is about an ownership issue, that will allow more and more companies fewer and fewer companies to own more and more media. In other words, we'll just have fewer owners, broadly speaking. Then aren't we looking at a sort of a narrowing universe of stories, because there will be corporate interests that in one way or another argue against coverage of certain issues.
And you know full well from your work as a reporter that there's this fairly small circle of media organizations all looking over each other's shoulders to see who's covering what. So, I mean, you take something like NPR, which is, you know, designed not to have any kind of corporate oversight, and yet I look at the New York Times and I look at the Washington Post and I see what the television stations are covering. And so in that way, all different options or places where stories like this could be covered end up getting closed down.
No question about it. We really are a pretty small club, Dick, as you know. And I would say, however, that interestingly enough, it was mostly public broadcast that covered this story well. There was a Bill Moyers. Bill Moyers really covered it.
Right.
And I think that that is partly because of the absence of the sort of corporate factor there. But, yeah, we really do pay attention to one another. And if somebody else isn't covering it, we say to ourselves, well, it's probably not very important.
And do you find then that people who are really looking for accurate information or more information are going outside the mainstream media, spending their time on the internet, for example?
Yeah, but you can access mainstream media on the internet. I mean, that's the good news. A citizen who wants to be well-informed today and has the time and resources to go after the information can be better informed than ever. You can go online and read international news sources. You can get them translated online. I think it's an extraordinary opportunity. But the average citizen reading the average one of America's 1,500 daily newspapers and listening to his or her local radio stations and watching local television or national broadcasts, what is their diet? That's part of what worries me. And I feel absolutely certain that that diet is becoming poorer, generally speaking.
All right, and to our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd also like to hear from you with your ideas about the big stories that were missed and why you think they were missed. Let's switch over to Rick Weiss now, who's been listening in on the phone from Washington, D.C. Rick's a science and medical reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for being with us. In your beat, tell me what you think we should be paying attention to. What are we missing?
You know, I think one thing that has struck me in the past year or so about science reporting is that it is becoming increasingly, or ought to be becoming, but I think is under-becoming, an art of paying attention not only to the science, but to the way that politics and business are influencing the science that's getting done and the science that's not getting done. I think that far more attention needs to be paid to the way that Congress and the politics of the current administration are influencing the direction of research, either overtly or covertly, and as Geneva has hinted at, the many ways that money is influencing the way that science is being done. And just, I can give you several examples, but overarchingly, you know, science used to be much more of a publicly funded enterprise in search of knowledge. And these days is becoming much more of a politically driven and business-driven enterprise in search of profits and political ends. And it happens so gradually that I think it's difficult for us to cover as a story. But before you know it, things have changed significantly.
Give me an example of what you're seeing, Rick, that we're not paying attention to.
You know, one thing that went by and got a little bit of coverage, but again wasn't expanded on, was this thing a few months ago where a conservative religious church coalition really got the ear of Congress and got the Justice Department involved in investigating why it was that NIH was funding research on such quote-unquote smarmy projects, that's what they called them, as you know, understanding why it is that truckers have sex in Africa with prostitutes, which, of course, is an incredibly important part of the puzzle of why AIDS is spreading in Africa. But since it had to do with sex, this group decided this sort of research should not be funded. The stem cell debate, of course, has been terribly caught up in the abortion debate, with a lot of people claiming that research should not be done on these embryonic cells, which show great therapeutic potential because embryos deserve the same level of respect as adults, which is a, you know, a political and religious point that people can debate but ought to be kept separate from the peer review process of deciding what is good science. And just maybe as a third example of politics, has been a real crackdown within the Department of Health and Human Services in how reporters can get information out of that agency under a rule promulgated by Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, that's been known as One Department, One Voice. It's gotten very difficult for us to get contact with real scientists and researchers on the ground. Everything has to go through a central information office. Messages are being tailored for us much more than they ever were before.
Okay, so that makes it harder for you to do your job as a reporter. What's the result on me when I'm trying to figure out what's going on and relying on you to tell me?
Well, you get a much more homogenized and pre-planned message, like so much of what's going on in politics today and in business. Everyone works out what their talking points are going to be, and that's pretty much the only points we get to hear, unless we all in the science journalism community become investigative journalists, a new set of skills that wasn't traditionally a requirement in the science reporting arena, but which I think increasingly really is a requirement if we want to do our job right.
And Geneva, this is the sort of thing that you must be trying to figure out at the journalism school level, that the skills required for a science reporter who could go straight to a researcher might not be enough for someone who's entering the field today.
Absolutely. And I think Rick's interesting point about science becoming more politically driven and business driven, that's true for the arts, it's true for education, it's certainly true for politics. So arming our students with both the passion for, but also the ability to go up against this, as Rick refers to, this remarkable, you know, we're framing everything the way we want it framed. And so much of what the public needs is not just reporting on various stories, but the question of when we report on it. We report on it at a time when the public can take advantage of knowing about it versus later when it's all over, or the way we report on it, as Rick was discussing, these science stories, you know, if we report on them as big religious debates, which is valid, but we don't report on them as the scientific stories they are at heart, then we're really not giving the public the information it needs.
And Rick, you were also talking about all those advisor positions, the people who are advising the CDC and the NIH and the FDI, that they used to be kind of more pure science, and now they're becoming more pure politics.
Yeah, this is a system that most people are not really aware of, but which plays a really important role in deciding what the priorities are going to be for, you know, the billions of dollars we spend in this country on scientific research. There are scientific advisory committees made up of experts, named by administration officials in various agencies to advise them, and it, you know, quietly one by one, there's hundreds of these committees. They're being repopulated by handpicked scientists, quote unquote experts, but those increasingly, it seems to me, with certain political agendas or political perspectives that start to bend the kind of advice they're giving.
Or industry connections?
Industry connections. There's one fine example, I think, a committee that's there to advise the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about environmental toxins, and that's supposed to give advice about chemicals in the environment that might have human health effects, which was almost completely repopulated in the last year or two by this administration to include lots of people with I think worryingly close ties to industry, including the guy who actually went up against the real Aaron Brockovich in the PG&E pollution debate or case many years ago. These things are very hard to document as a big trend. I mean, it happens little by little, and it certainly isn't unique to this administration, but a lot of people tell me it's happening more than they've ever seen before.
Rick, thanks so much for being with us on the program.
You're welcome.
Rick Weiss is science and medical reporter for The Washington Post, giving me ideas about stories that we are paying more attention to in the year that's ahead of us. But Connection listeners, also, we want to hear from you, 1-800-423-8255, about stories, issues, areas that you think are underreported and why. Give us a call. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Geneva Overholser is with me on this hour. She's editorial writer and professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. And we're talking about the stories that you think were missed in the past year. 1-800-423-8255. And more to the point, why you think those stories don't get the attention that they should. Let's go to Arlington, Massachusetts now. And Helen is with us. Hi, Helena. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Dick. Thanks very much for taking my call. Even better show than usual. I'm unhappy that the new government in Kenya hasn't gotten more coverage than it has. Though it's far from a perfect government, they're making a real effort to greatly reduce, they say eliminate, the level of corruption. They've instituted free education in primary schools, and the result is that there are only one-fifth as many school-age children out of school as there were before. They haven't quite got everyone yet.
Why do you think it's not getting the attention that it is?
I think there are several reasons. It's far away. It's expensive to cover. I don't think that most Americans know a great deal about Africa and therefore don't demand much beyond the war and AIDS. And frankly, I suspect that the number of people who can cover African stories well is somewhat limited. It's, you know, easier to cover the State Department or harvests in Iowa or whatever than to cover the stories in a region that one doesn't know very much about.
And I think perhaps it may also fall into that category of not being a disastrous news story. So
exactly. That's perfectly true. It's good news from Africa, and I know that the press, you know, likes to print good news from Africa when they notice it, but this one hasn't gotten as much notice as I think it should have.
Geneva, you worked, 5 years as a freelance reporter covering stories in Africa. Is Helena talking about issues that are close to your heart?
Oh, man, I just agreed with every word she said. She's more measured than I would be. I think we woefully undercover Africa for all the reasons she said, but also because I think we're doing a less and less effective job of bringing international news home to people, even as the world grows closer and closer together and we become more and more powerful. But yeah, Africa is remarkably undercovered. Part of it is expenses. Again, we're not using the profits of media to expand our news coverage. We're dropping them to the bottom line. But Africa matters, and good news from Africa would make good reading or good viewing or listening, and we're really not covering it.
Let's bounce across the Atlantic to Matthew Paris, who's standing by on the line from Bristol. Matthew's a columnist for the Times of London, a former member of the British House of Parliament. Matthew, good of you to join us.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to this conversation about Africa. Are there other stories that are on your list of places or people or issues that were missed?
Yeah, I must say, listening to the discussion of Africa, I was reminded of something Adlai Stevenson once said, that the American public will do anything for Latin America except read about it. And there are big stories abroad that I think are being eclipsed by the Iraq war. Why don't we take the two wars that went before, for a start? Afghanistan. There are problems in Afghanistan that the peace is not being won as easily as the war. The situation's fairly stable. Mohammad Karzai is more or less in control in Kabul, but the north of Afghanistan is more or less under the control of warlords. Mm-hmm. The opium harvest this year, which is the heroin trade, is bigger than ever, although one of the purposes of breaking up the Taliban was supposed to be to put an end to that, and there is no end in sight. Go back one further, the Balkans. The British, we have a British politician, Paddy Ashdown, who's effectively now the governor of Bosnia. He's called the United Nations High Representative. The situation is stable there, but it's costing a lot of money, and there's no evidence that Bosnia is developing the sort of functioning democracy which would allow the United Nations and our British governor to withdraw. Kosovo was supposed to be going to be a province where power was shared between the Albanian majority and the Serb minority, but the Serb minority are being squeezed and bullied out, and we're getting effectively a little Albanian statelet growing there. We forget these things, and in our excitement, as it were, at the new conquest, the new occupation, we can forget how difficult it is to consolidate the old one.
Well, looking at it from the perspective of journalism, Matthew, is it a lack of resources? Is it a lack of interest? Or is it just an inability to focus on more than one story at a time?
Well, I can only speak for the British public here. The British public has an appetite for no more than one foreign story at a time. I'm afraid that my readers just can't handle two big foreign stories. Another example is Europe. Europe is absolutely at the crossroads. The European Union about to expand to 23 people, and the 23 countries. The European Union has no idea how decisions are going to be taken, and they've just failed to reach agreement again on a new structure. There's no discussion, or has been very little discussion of this in Britain. We're absolutely transfixed on bombings in Baghdad.
Geneva, when Matthew says this is the picture in Britain, does it sound familiar to what you see from Washington?
Absolutely. I suppose I'm somewhat reassured if Matthew feels that the Times of London's readers can focus on only one foreign story at a time, then I feel a little less ashamed of how little we're giving our readers. I can't help thinking, though, that are we sure that our readers can focus on only one story at a time? We're certainly justifying ourselves in saying that because we're giving them only one story at a time. But Lord knows we give them a huge overdose of one story at a time. And I can't help thinking some of them would like, thank you, to know what is going on in Afghanistan or in Kosovo. Sometimes I think we may underestimate them in order to justify our own simple choice.
What do you think?
I agree with that. And I think actually the American newspapers are rather better than British papers in this. You look at the front page of a serious American newspaper and the inside pages, and you'll get a visual impression of a great many things happening. But the approach of British journalists to the layout of a British newspaper, even a serious one, is what is the splash? What is today's splash? And splash is the word, and splash doesn't really leave much scope for anything else.
Matthew, thanks for taking a few moments out of your day to be with us.
Pleasure.
Matthew Paris, columnist for the Times of London, former member of the British House of Parliament. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And Connection listeners, what about your thoughts on stories that were missed and why? Next to Brookline, Massachusetts. Mike, you're with us. Hi.
Thank you very much. The failure of the war on drugs. American policy is an anachronism in the rest of the world. We still arrest drug users while the rest of the world is saving money and saving lives by treating them.
Are you talking about a failure of U.S. policy, or are you talking about drugs and the spread of drugs through society?
Well, the spread of drugs through society is engendered and made worse by drug prohibition. That's what went wrong with alcohol prohibition back in the 20s, and that is a policy that the United States is trying to force on the rest of the world, including the federal government trying to force it on the states, that has made things worse. Drugs are more plentiful than ever, are purer than ever, so that people can get hooked easier, and there's less resources available to treat people for drug abuse because we're so busy locking people up. We lock more people up in this country for possession of drugs than is locked up in the entire EU for all offenses.
Mike, we're talking today about why certain stories aren't covered. Why is this one, in your view, not covered?
It's not covered because, first of all, I think there is an enormous investment in both the narcocracy of people that build prisons and prison guard unions that make it an anathema, a third rail for particularly Democrats to try to talk about because they'll be vilified as being soft on crime. And because, I mean, I don't know why investigative reporters aren't all over this. This is a huge budget buster that is beggaring both the things that can do something about drug abuse, drug treatment, and putting corruption into our police forces.
Right.
I wish I knew the answer why the mainstream press does not give more attention to this absolute nickel and dime budget deficit increasing issue that has an impact on every one of our lives.
Let's go to Geneva and see if she's got some notions on this one.
Well, I think Mike's raised a good one. This is a huge story. My theory would be that it is one of these stories where something is around for a long time, is clearly a very big problem, but because it isn't being discussed in political discourse, the media don't find, so to speak, hooks. I think we need to remember that a lot of what gets into the media gets there because it's being raised by political leaders. And as Mike notes, this is not a popular political subject. So it's not getting in the papers or in other media. One journalist has proposed that we have something called Still True, I think is what he wanted to call it. And, you know, we'd have it on the newspaper.
I like it.
Every day there'd be this little thing, Still True Today, you know, X number of addicts or people jailed or whatever, you know, lack of treatment. The average editor will resist it because it feels a little bit editorial, but hell, we make editorial judgments every time we pick a story topic. I think there's some merit in it's Still True, and that would be a good one, Still True, the drug problem.
You know, we'll talk more about different stories, but you've raised something that I just want to test with you, Geneva, and that is when an opposition political party doesn't make something of a story, is that an excuse for journalists then not to cover it? I mean, how much is that kind of cozy little relationship between whoever happens to be in opposition and whoever is reporting have to do with the types of stories that we see in print or hear on radio?
Well, I would phrase it a little differently, Dick. I mean, I think it's not an excuse, but it's an explanation, and I wouldn't put it down as cozy. It's a matter of fact that in a democracy, part of the appropriate role of the press is to accurately reflect the political discourse. And when the political discourse is poor or weak, or as I think it's been since 9/11, at least until recently, quiescent practically in terms of debate, that affects reporting. Now, that doesn't mean we don't report independently, but anybody who thinks the press is all about originating its own reporting and it has nothing to do with the democratic process is wrong, and that wouldn't be a good way to do it in any case. But, you know, yeah, we should do our own investigative reporting, and I'm sure there have been some good pieces of investigative reporting on drug problems in given cities across America during this past year. But sure, we're affected by what the politicians say, and how would it be otherwise in a democracy?
1-800-423-8255. Next to Brookline, Massachusetts. Philip, you're with us. Hi.
Good morning, Dick. Good morning, Geneva. As a former environmental reporter, I see a failure of the media today to put together what is happening on the environment. And that is nothing less than a systematic rollback of the system of environmental protection that has been developed over almost a half century now. And here again, I think it is a case of business along with the ideological right getting just about everything it wants. I saw a report on the web yesterday, for example, that the Bush administration is now secretly negotiating a sweetheart deal with agribusiness to exempt these hog and beef and chicken farms, these massive farms, from the Clean Air Act and the Superfund negotiations. There's been a lot of individual stories out on these issues, but they haven't been put together to show what is actually happening.
Why not, Philip? Why, I mean, is it that hard to take a step back and a look at the overall here?
I think it is that editors and media managers really don't know how to deal with these stories. They're not acute stories. They're not a terrorist attack. They're not a war. They're not the plunging the stock market. They're not the World Series. These are chronic stories rather than acute stories, and therefore they tend to get ignored because they're not dramatic. They're not infotainment, they're probably the environment is arguably the most important story there is, particularly on the global level where the global environment is just flying apart right now, and hardly anybody is paying attention to it in terms of putting together what is happening.
And there's that other funny twist to it, Geneva, where in dealing with the environmental policy of this administration, the Republicans who are now in office will make a change and say, this is good for the environment. And it gets caught up in a way in a sort of reporter 101 sense of, oh, well, we've got to be balanced. And in some cases, it's like the old argument over the Kyoto Protocol. One side says it's good and the other side says it's bad. And the journalist step back and says, well, I've done my job.
Yeah, this is really one of my top three as well. And I'm so glad this caller raised it because I think, you know, you have good individual pieces of reporting on what's happening with private use of forest lands or mercury and water or global warming, but really putting it all together and seeing how environmental policy has changed over recent years, I just don't see it happening. And I think, again, part of it is that I don't see part of what happens in this country at its best is that you have people in power and then you have a sort of a loyal opposition and they raise issues and then they're discussed. But I don't think this issue is being raised very effectively, and I think people do care about it. I think the problem of it's not being acute is one of the issues here. But this is the kind of story that, you know, herein lies tragedy if we don't think about how to deal with it and bring it before people. And I think the media aren't doing a very good job of it, partly, Dick, as you said, because it becomes part of a political question. And the loudest voice is speaking it's heard. It's those in power who are bringing about these policies, and the media aren't questioning them very much.
Let's go back to our phones. Reminder, our number is 1-800-423-8255. And where are we off to? Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And Tom, you're with us. Hi, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I want to pick up on an earlier theme, the corruption of the language has in large part led to the media missing, I think, the biggest story of the year, and that is the massive redistribution of wealth within the United States, both through changes in tax laws, corporate malfeasance, and just a general draining of the middle class, with wealth going to those who have money and those in the middle class struggling to make a go of it.
Why is that a language question for you, Tom?
Well, because of, earlier we talked about how language has been distorted in the way that the Bush environmental efforts have been portrayed. Same thing with corporate.
Tax cuts are good for all of us.
That's right. Tax cuts are good. They're just a few bad apples in industry, but the list goes on and on. Enron, Halliburton, HealthSouth, Tyco, even companies like AT&T, where no one's indicted. There are a lot of instances of money changing hands in ways that really aren't right. And the government, and by that I mean the Bush administration, has largely supported that in many ways.
So why aren't people paying attention? Why doesn't it get
again,
attention?
Again, harking back to what we said earlier, I don't think the dots have been connected between the lines. There are many isolated stories, but the stories are part of a larger picture. And it's that inability of the mass media to paint the larger picture that's the bigger problem. They're very good at individual stories, bad apples, but when the entire picture leads in a certain direction, the media has a very hard time putting that all together for reasons that I don't want to get into right now.
No, but I mean, and you've put your finger on one that is about as big as it gets. I mean, you're talking about the whole shape of society. How do you fit that into an eight-word headline or a six-column story, right?
Well, it's the country is getting poor in many ways, both in terms of language and in terms of wealth, and the few who are benefiting are basically in control of the mass media, which was the first topic of the program, and in control of the government, and in control of basically most of the decision making. And so in many ways we're asked to rubber stamp what the government is doing.
Tom, I want to thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
1-800-423-8255. We take a short break right now, but stay with us. Geneva Overholser is with us on the program as well. We're talking about stories in 2003 that were missed and why they were missed. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, a conversation about stories that were missed in 2003. And Tom puts a good one on the table for us, Geneva, with society and wealth and distribution. And I'm thinking, you know, he's so right, and yet it's one of those still true stories, isn't it?
It is. And I couldn't help thinking as I listened to Tom, and I think he's exactly right about this huge story and how important it is. You will have read almost all those elements. If you were reading, say, the New York Times all this past year, you would certainly read the economic statistics showing that the very rich are getting much richer and that their middle class is shrinking. You certainly would have read lots of specific stories about different corporate scandals. And you'd even have read people commentary putting it together. When I was writing a column, I was writing about this, and I was regularly bashed for attempting to incite class warfare or something.
Yeah, Paul Krugman does it on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah,
Kevin Phillips can read
all this, and I can't help thinking again, Dick, that part of this is we're of course examining the media, and we should, but we have to remember that the media work within a larger society, and other things make a difference. I mean, my story about the FCC being underreported, eventually it came to public attention because the people like MoveOn.org and others brought it out, and then Congress responded to pressure, and then it became a big story. The media don't operate in a vacuum, and what the politicians are saying counts. And one reason I raised that in this case, and Tom's point, the public seems not to get exercised over this, and I don't quite get it. I mean, the Bush administration has been very effective at persuading people that he is meeting their interests, even though if you looked at it from a purely economic standpoint, you would wonder if, in fact, those certain sectors of society that are supporting him, if their economic interests are being met.
Mm-hmm. Let's move along to, where are we going next, to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Hollett, you're joining us. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to just point out that I think crimes against women in Iraq has been largely missed in news coverage.
Do you mean since the war?
Since the war and during the CPA occupation, yes. During the CPA administration, there's been all kinds of crimes against women, and it's been very hard to find any news coverage of it. The only thing I found is by Eve Essler, who was reported on female slavery in Iraq and how she saw price tags on women in Iraq. But other than that, it's almost impossible to find news on crimes against women in Iraq.
We've done some coverage of that, and I've seen some other in places, Khalid. So when you add it all up, what's your concern here?
My real concern is that there hasn't really been enough outrage at the CPA, and the fact that they don't seem to be moving in any kind of direction towards creating a women's rights division, for example,
right,
or for pursuing legal action against people who are abusing women in Iraq. And it was a big deal in Afghanistan, but it seems to be forgotten largely by the American public in Iraq.
I'm glad you raised it. I think, Geneva, this perhaps is one of the most complicated stories that we've had to deal with in a long, long time. And we're months into this relationship that the United States has with Iraq right now, and still some of the most senior politicians and journalists are arguing about whether or not it's an occupation or not, even how to define it.
Boy, I agree with you. I think it's exceedingly complex.
And does that mean that we need to spend more time on this? Because in a way, that's kind of contradicting where we began earlier, Geneva, by saying too much Iraq all the time. We need to bring a little bit more nuance to the table.
Well, optimally, we'd be spending more thoughtful time on it, right? It's so hard to report well on. But I think we're getting pretty good reporting out of Iraq. One thing I would say is that we're getting much better reporting now than we got before the war in terms of raising difficult questions and probing and really pressing for answers.
We still hear that from people who call up here saying, you guys are talking about, what happened last week, and we never got to the bottom of the weapons of mass destruction. We never got to, some of the really fundamental questions about how this war began in the first place.
Oh, I just really think that's true. We were not pressing. This is a question of when you report. We were not pressing on the question of whether there were links between al-Qaeda and Saddam. We weren't pressing on what we knew about weapons of mass destruction. We weren't pressing about the rest of the world's views. We also, I think, weren't pressing on Saddam's record of how awful his behavior had been against his own people and elsewhere. I just don't think we were pressing for the tough questions before the war began. It began almost as a given. It was a remarkable process to watch. And since then, the reporting, I think, has gotten much better, but mm-hmm. needed to be better before.
Let's go to Stowe, Massachusetts, and Dave's joining us now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Dick. Hi, Geneva. Thanks so much for the show. I don't have a particular story that I think hasn't been covered, but maybe a reason why an awful lot of these stories aren't being covered. When I listen to what you're saying, we're talking about drug laws, we're talking about all sorts of issues, environmental degradation of the Bush administration, or whatever, however you want to put it. They're all stories that, if exposed, would cause the media to be accused of having a liberal bent. And I think the media is afraid of that. I do also believe that the consolidation of power has, within the media, and the, perhaps the more conservative outlook of the media may have something to do with it as well. But I think that's a huge part of the problem. People don't want to be challenged and told, maybe there's a reason for a liberal bent. I mean, I guess I'm a liberal, so I would argue that when you get informed, maybe you become liberal. But that certainly lets my allegiances be known.
I wonder, Dave, if we can trace this fairly specifically back to 9/11 at a moment where the media's fear of being seen to be either skeptical or liberal was so well squashed, depending on how you look at it.
That I would agree entirely. It's a lot harder in a you know, a time of war to be challenging the administration and all. But by the same token, I completely agree with the argument that's been put out there that Bush and his buddies have taken total advantage of that. You know, you can see how it works both ways.
And Geneva, you had an experience like that with former Senator Alan Simpson. Tell us that, about that.
This is a good one. Of course, we all have to acknowledge we're all suspect on the liberal front as soon as we start talking about it. But I think there is a very effective onslaught of kind of the liberal media charge that the media hates to hear, just as our caller has said, and that after 9/11, as you said, Dick, this got worse. You were mentioning the Alan Simpson. I was on the tube shortly after 9/11, and the former senator from Wyoming, real smart, interesting, funny guy, totally outclassed me on the program, no doubt. He waved his big, long index finger at me and said, "Now, finally, maybe you all will give up your skepticism." And I said, "With all due respect, Senator, I think skepticism is patriotism for journalists. But there is no question that it made it even harder to do the things that you felt would make the public dislike you. You throw in this marketing pressure that the media are broadly under these days, and it makes for a pretty toxic mix."
What do you mean by marketing pressure?
Well, what I mean is, with all the profit pressures on the media, part of what's happening from on high is we got to do what the reader wants, we got to do what the reader likes. And there were some very dramatic examples. You probably remember after 9/11, some radio stations, commercial radio stations, were being told that, you know, the more they played patriotic music, the higher their ratings would go, and the less they talked about demonstrations, public demonstrations, you know, the better off they'd be. Well, that kind of thing is not nearly that dramatic for most media, but the notion that you don't want to be too far outside the boundaries of acceptable behavior, and those boundaries change during wartime, they change when the nation has been attacked. Those have all added into this mix, and I think it's, as I say, it's made a real difference in reporting.
And that's not that new. I mean, Dave mentioned it in good context. You've picked up on it, just the idea that the nation is still at war, and that creates a funny space for journalism.
Mm-hmm. But I wish we would more often tell ourselves that it is patriotic to raise these questions. And I think plenty of the public believe that. I think there's been a strong backlash against really sort of a supine media after 9/11. So we ought to worry about that from a marketing standpoint then.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to Providence, Rhode Island. Jerry, you're with us. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Dick. Good morning, Geneva.
Good morning.
Listen, there was something that happened. I heard this story once, I don't know, in the middle of the night, there was a young black man who was killed by the police. I believe the town, it was either Miami or Fort Lauderdale. And I'm sorry, I can't be more specific, but I swear I only heard the story once. The story never caught on.
This isn't the one about the man being beaten in Cincinnati.
No, this was last summer.
Okay.
This young man would be about 17 or 18 years old. It came out that he was dating the policeman's daughter, who was not African American, he was, and somehow he ended up being killed. It was suspected that it was by this policeman and other police in his department, because obviously it was an interracial situation. Story ran once and just died.
Is it your view, Jerry, that's connected in some way to where Geneva began the program by saying that there's less and less diversity in the media, and perhaps it's by extension easier to control stories like this?
Yeah, because it's a very unpleasant story to begin with, and further you have the whole political consideration where the story took place in Florida, and Florida, it still has a very bad name because of the way African Americans were treated during the 2000 election.
And Geneva, Jerry's reminding me of what a small amount of reporting there is about race in America today.
Absolutely true. Every now and then a story comes along like this remarkable story of Strom Thurmond's daughter that makes you realize how much there is to be said about it and how powerful it is for all of us. And then everybody reports on this story, but there isn't enough. I think That's absolutely true. It's certainly true about black-white issues. It's also, I can't help wondering if we aren't underreporting the major story of the rise of Hispanic America in the U.S.
Because that's, I mean, the influence in that story, boy, you look at it on the East Coast, it's different from the West Coast, and the South it's huge, and yeah. It's not in the newspapers, is it?
Or no, well,
on
it
the,
seems
I
like
should
a,
I say in the newspapers, but I'm meaning on the radio or television
in,
as
in
well.
In the media, yeah. It seems like a big political story.
Do you think that there is less investigative reporting today than there was 5, 10, 15 years ago, Geneva?
Definitely, and I think the investigative reporters and editors, this wonderful organization that supports investigative reporters, would say that. There have been recent books written about this. Investigative reporting takes money, Dick. You know, you've got a newsroom, you've got to deploy talented people, you've got to keep them off the regular beat for weeks while they dig into something. Often they need to be trained in, you know, computer-assisted reporting or just in reporting generally. The paper's got to dedicate considerable news hole.
Well, I remember NPR getting whacked when one of its top investigative reporters was reassigned to something else. I mean, you say it takes money, but you can spend a ton of money on an investigative story and end up with nothing, right?
You can, exactly. You've got to be willing to shoot that amount of resources and then come up with nothing. And then when you put it on the air, you're likely to, you know, annoy a lot of people as well. Sort of, people don't always want to be told the bad news. And investigative reporting often ends up uncovering difficult issues. So it's still happening, I must say. It's important to note that, I mean, all my gloom and doom, I think we have terrific, terrific reporting in this country. And boy, whenever I judge a contest, my 9 years on the Pulitzer Board certainly made me feel this way. We have great reporting in this country, so we mustn't forget that. But yes, investigative reporting, which is an absolutely important, you know, piece of what we offer the democracy, is on the decline, I'm afraid, and I think it's a real resource issue.
Let me ask you to turn in the other direction for just half a minute here, Geneva, and tell us what stories ought not to be missed as we move ahead. Is there one that you're hoping gets a little bit more attention in the new year?
Well, I think that this question of how effectively the Republican Party has gotten itself together to, with remarkable skill, shape the political debate, and how ineffectively the Democratic Party has responded. We're beginning to hear now that people on the left are launching, you know, various kinds of media or think tanks or... But we haven't been seeing this story as it built, and it's really shaped the country. So it'll be interesting to see that one continue.
Geneva, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Dick. It's a pleasure.
All right, best of the season to you. Geneva Overholser is an editorial writer and professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. Earlier in the program, we talked with Rick Weiss, a science and medical reporter from The Washington Post, and Matthew Paris, a columnist for The Times of London. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.